60 Minutes in the programme. We'll be talking to Tom Boland of the Higher Education Authority about a report out today which shows, and I've mentioned this already, big differences in access to third level education, as low as 1 in 5 or even lower in some parts of Dublin, as many as 99 in 100 in other parts of Dublin going to college, and what the authority proposes to do about that. Also, George Lee will be talking to us about beef, and we'll be interviewing the winning Rose of Tralee.
But the time is a minute past eight on Wednesday, the 20th of August. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Cathal McQuillia and Christopher McKevitt.
The news headlines. A man has been shot dead in Saggart in County Dublin. Farmers have expressed outrage about the prospect of another cut in the price they get for beef. The UN is beginning one of its biggest aid operations for refugees in Iraq. And Maria Walsh, representing Philadelphia, was crowned Rose of Tralee last night. The news in full from Brian Jennings.
A man in his 40s has been killed in a gun attack in Saggart in southwest County Dublin. Gardaí were alerted to the shooting at Boher Boy shortly after 11 o'clock last night. The man was shot a number of times in the upper body. He was brought to hospital, where he was pronounced dead shortly after midnight. The man had been known to Gardaí. British retailers are planning to further change the specifications of the beef they're willing to buy, a move that would reduce farm incomes in Ireland. At a meeting of farmers in Navan and County Meath last night, Padraig Brown, the group procurement director of the Dunbia Meat Group, said some retailers were lowering yet again the age limit they had imposed for bull calf beef. The IFA said it would be impossible for Irish farmers to meet such specifications. Our agriculture and environment correspondent, George Lee.
The meeting of farmers held in Navan was the first of four regional IFA meetings about the deteriorating beef crisis, which has seen the price that farmers get for their beef cut by about €200 per animal compared with last year. A lot of anger and frustration was expressed from the floor, and attempts were made by some to prevent a representative from the beef industry from speaking at all. When Padraig Brown, the group procurement director of the meat group Dunbia, finally did get to speak, his message to farmers was far from reassuring. He explained that some of the main British retailers who buy Irish beef are now looking to introduce even more rigorous specifications for the beef that they buy, and that some have already imposed an even lower age limit than the age limit they imposed last October, which triggered the beef crisis in the first place. Certain retailers, he said, have lowered the age limit to 14 months for bull beef in some cases and to as low as 12 months old in others. When it was put to him by the IFA president Eddie Downey that a 14-month-old age limit for bull beef was a nonsense and that Irish farmers could not have a grass-fed animal ready by that stage, Mr. Brown said that other people in the UK are already doing it. He added that the trouble that beef farmers are now suffering is the direct result of the fallout from the horsemeat scandal of 18 months ago.
The United Nations begins one of its biggest aid operations for refugees in Iraq today. Tents and other goods will be sent to the Kurdish city of Erbil for more than 500,000 people displaced by fighting in northern Iraq. The Iraqi ambassador to the United States, Luqman Feili, has said the outcome of the fight against the Islamic State militants would have repercussions throughout the Middle East. Palestinian officials have said that seven members of a family, including a woman and three children, have been killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza City. It's also reported that a senior Hamas militant, Mohammed Daif, has been targeted by one of the Israeli attacks. Local media said that his wife and two-year-old daughter had been killed. Hamas has said it has fired dozens of rockets at Iraq. Some of the rockets were shot down by Israel's defence system, known as Iron Dome. No casualties have been reported. The hostilities followed the breakdown of peace talks in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Police in St. Louis, Missouri, have given more details about the killing of a man by one of their officers yesterday. The shooting happened 10 days after the killing, also by a police officer, of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager in the suburb of Ferguson. A spokesman for St. Louis Metropolitan Police said they shot at a 23-year-old black man yesterday after he had threatened officers with a knife. Two officers opened fire again after he refused repeated orders to drop his weapon. The St. Louis police chief, Sam Dotson, defended the actions of his officers.
I think officer safety is the number one issue. So if somebody approaches you within 3 feet with a knife, I think you have the right to defend yourself and protect yourself. I think it certainly is reasonable that an officer has an expectation to go home at the end of the night. I think we can all understand what's going on in Ferguson, but I think every police officer that's out here has a right to defend themselves and the community.
Liberia has imposed a nighttime curfew and quarantined two areas of the capital, Monrovia, in an attempt to contain the deadly Ebola outbreak. The Liberian government yesterday said 17 suspected Ebola patients who fled a health centre in Monrovia when it was attacked at the weekend had been found. Ordinary rubber bands could be transformed into wearable sensors for monitoring blood pressure, joint movement and blood glucose, as a result of a discovery by researchers at the Amber Materials Centre at Trinity College Dublin. The method involves adding graphene to the rubber bands, the first time this has ever been achieved anywhere in the world. Our science and technology correspondent, Will Goodbody.
Dubbed a wonder material, graphene is made from a single flat layer of carbon atoms. It's super strong, flexible and conductive, and scientists believe it will in future be used to make all sorts of products, from flexible mobile phones to lighter aeroplanes. But researchers at the Amber Materials Science Centre and the School of Physics at Trinity College Dublin have found another use. In a paper published in the journal ACS Nano, they describe how adding graphene to shop-bought rubber bands can transform them into wearable sensors. The world-first technique makes the rubber conduct electricity without degrading its mechanical properties. As the stretching of the bands strongly affects the flow of electrical current, the bands can sense tiny movements, like a pulse when attached to clothing, for example. The scientists say the discovery will lead to multiple uses in areas like healthcare, the automotive industry and robotics.
Maria Walsh, representing Philadelphia, was crowned the Rose of Tralee last night. Ms. Walsh, a native of Boston, Massachusetts, moved to Philadelphia 3 years ago. She studied journalism and visual media in Dublin and graduated in 2009. She was chosen from 32 finalists. The presenter, Dahi O'Shea, announced the winner following two nights of interviews at the Dome in Tralee.
Ladies and gentlemen, the 2014 International Rose of Tralee is... Philadelphia!
Now the time is exactly 8 minutes past eight.
The time is 9 minutes past eight here with, it says in the papers, is Valerie Cox.
Fine Gael will suffer. That's the chill warning on the front of the Irish Sun this morning, and it comes from an interview Deglan de Bredon has with Lucinda Creighton. I think the public are very angry, she says. You can sum it up in two words, broken promises. Children of farmers are three times more likely to go to college. That's the headline on the Irish Independent, which dips into a new report from the Higher Education Authority. Catherine Donnelly says it puts the spotlight on how one's address and family background remain significant predictors of whether or not you will get a degree. Also on the front page, abortion case girl got lost in the system. It says the HSE was informed that there were serious concerns for the mental health of a young woman when she was 14 weeks pregnant and actively seeking abortion. The Irish Times leads with this story and says the revelation raises new questions about the HSE's role in her case and why she was not referred at this stage to a GP, who could then refer her on to a psychiatrist under the terms of the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act. Maurice Houston says most parties will agree that on this occasion the Act failed to offer guidance to doctors on the most appropriate response to a request for termination that is made on the cusp of viability when a pregnancy approaches 24 weeks gestation. The Irish Examiner leads with another medical story. Catherine Shanahan reporting that patients not fit for day surgery could end up going under the knife because a significant number of hospitals do not routinely conduct pre-operative assessments to identify potential risks. For two of the tabloids, their lead is all about Pat Kenny, who, according to the Irish Daily Star, has signed a megabucks deal with UTV Ireland that will net him a massive $1 million over 5 years. Pat's new Late Late Show, says the Irish Daily Mirror. Spider killed my hubby, says the Sun. An Irish dad of five died after being bitten by a spider while watching a movie. Pope, I may be forced to quit, says the Irish Daily Mail. On his papal plane returning from South Korea, he spoke about his death for the first time, giving himself 2 or 3 years to live. He also indicated that if his fragile health deteriorated, he might follow his predecessor Benedict by retiring as Pope. In other stories, Sam Griffin in The Independent says Irish Airlines have been put on alert amid fears that seismic activity at Iceland's largest volcano could cause a new ash cloud. The Times continues its series on country life. Tim O'Brien has been to Finnay on the border of counties Westmeath and Cavan, where 3-year-old Cara Fitzsimons is the only pupil signed up for September's intake of junior infants in the local national school. But the small number of young children is only one fact of life in Finnay, writes O'Brien. The Philadelphia Rose, Maria Walsh, was last night crowned as the Rose of Tralee. But a letter writer to the Times, Frank Byrne from Dublin, says obviously it would be churlish to complain about an annual parade of pulchritudinous ladies participating in a personality contest. However, perhaps the time has come to consider a similar competition for male contestants. I suggest the Thorn of Tramore has a pleasing ring to it, he says. And all the papers report that Rose of Tralee host Zahi O'Shea underwent the Ice Bucket Challenge on Monday night. This involves raising funds for charitable causes by dumping buckets of ice and freezing water onto the participants. Two of his nominees, Ryan Tubridy and Marty Whelan, both underwent the stunt on air yesterday morning, writes Fiacra O'Kyunny in The Examiner, although he notes that RTE bosses will perhaps be less than pleased at the thought of its top stars sneezing and spluttering.
Valerie Cox, it is 13 minutes past 8 o'clock. 8:15, there's been a fatal shooting of a man in County Dublin. It happened late last night. The victim was pronounced dead in hospital. Well, our reporter Joe McGreely is at the scene. Joe, what can you tell us?
Yes, Christopher, I'm right outside a private house in Boherboy, which is just outside Saggart Village, the scene of this shooting last night. Now, Gardaí got the call to come here around 11 o'clock, and when they arrived here, they found a man in the house. He was in his 40s, and he had been shot a number of times by a single gunman. Now, as he said, he was rushed to Tallaght Hospital, but was pronounced dead there before midnight, and his body remains at the hospital, where a post-mortem is due to take place later on. Now, the house, which is newly built, with work still going on at the site, is sealed off for forensic examination. A silver 5-series BMW car sitting in the driveway, and there's a number of plain clothes and uniform Gardaí present here at the scene. And of course, Gardaí are appealing for anyone with information to get in contact with them concerning this incident last night. The identity of the dead man has not yet been released, pending the notification of all his family, but I understand that he was well known to Gardaí.
And the fact that he was shot a number of times, it suggests obviously this may well have been a planned shooting. Have the Gardaí been able to say any more about the circumstances around this unfortunate case?
Apart from the details they've given, they're not giving anything else beyond that. It happened, as I said, at 11 p.m. last night, and obviously their investigation now is all about finding out who was behind the shooting and examining the scene forensically. The forensic officers have not yet got here, but the area remains sealed off, and there are a good number of Garda officers here at the scene at the moment.
Joe McGreely in Saggart this morning for us. Thank you very much for that. It's 17 minutes past 8.
And we're going to talk now about this report on educational access, which shows or confirms yet again in some detail the report from the Higher Education Authority that third level colleges are a bit like the Ritz Hotel, open to all in theory, but the reality, as we know, but as I say, it's spelt out in this report again, is quite different. And we're joined by the Chief Executive of the Authority, Tom Boland. Good morning and welcome. The figures, I've mentioned some of them already, stark differences between the highest and the lowest. Just give us an idea of what you see as what shows the overall picture, what's happening and what the differences are.
Yeah, the context here, first of all, Cathal, is that the Higher Education Authority, in partnership with the Minister of Education and Skills, her department, we're working towards the development of a new plan for equity of access to higher education. This will be the third in a series of plans. And the paper that's published with the facts you're talking about is a consultation paper. We want a plan by the end of the year, and we want to get a wide range of views as to how we address this problem of inequity in higher education. Now,
How great is the inequity? Give us an idea.
There has been great progress, but the national average is 52% of 17 to 19 year olds go on to higher education. That ranges from as high as 60% in places like Galway and Mayo to as low as 16% in Ballyfermot in Dublin 10. So it's a huge span. And what it and within that span also it demonstrates areas of the country where in fact there is effectively full participation in higher education. In other words, virtually all eligible young people go on to higher education. And in other parts of the country, virtually no young people go on to higher education. So it's a very, very mixed picture. It's a picture of considerable success overall. But what it is showing...
When you say considerable success overall, in what way, how much?
In the sense, for instance, I'd give you another statistic in a report with lots of statistics. In the context of the proportion of our population with higher level qualifications, we top the EU in 30 to 34 year olds.
And it's still improving nationally.
And still improving nationally. So that's good. But what we have, though, are some very deep pockets of disadvantage. And the problem, the key problem here is that it seems to be resilient to any solution, if I could put it that way.
Because you've set targets on various categories and haven't met them.
We have met targets in quite a number of areas, but one area where we have not met targets, we have not met targets in some areas of students with disabilities, which are equally important, but a much bigger group is for lower socioeconomic groups, the lowest socioeconomic groups, which have remained more or less static in terms of the participation in higher education.
Now, you're starting a consultation process, so you're looking for ideas. But are we talking here about things like the Access Programme in DCU, which Louise Byrne reported on earlier? Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
Look, there are great programmes happening right across the sector, and the DCU one is a great example, and I take my hat off to the Access Officers, people like Eta Tobin, who was on your programme earlier. Wonderful, wonderful programmes. Nevertheless, evidence-based policy, the evidence is that we are not reaching a certain proportion of the population, and that there are still very significant barriers to access for many, many people. I think the programmes in the universities and in the Institute of Technology, they're very sound, but I think what we need is some kind of much more systemic approach, particularly to address areas of deep disadvantage. And this isn't, Carl, this isn't just a kind of a nice-to-do social issue. There is a hard-nosed economic issue around these huge reservoirs of talent. You can call them reservoirs of disadvantage or pools of disadvantage, but in fact they're reservoirs of talent for Ireland. We need the skills of those young people.
Right, two questions that are fairly obvious I just want to ask you about. The first is, access programmes are fine in letting people in with lower, on a lower marks in their Leaving Cert or whatever. That's all good. But have you got the evidence to show that if you do that, that the end result is what it should be? I mean, do they perform, these people who are coming on these access programmes, do they actually make it through to the end of college?
They do.
Obviously not all.
They are certainly no worse. They're as good as students that come in in the ordinary way, let's put it like that. And certainly some anecdotal evidence would suggest they are better. The ESRI, a short time back, did a study on two programmes, the Here and There, the Higher Education Access Route and the Disability Access Route. They were positive in their assessment of those programmes. The difficulty still seems to be, though, that even programs like that are not getting down into really deprived, financially deprived, economically deprived communities.
You mean, in other words, they're bringing in people who should get in, and that's welcome.
Absolutely.
But there's a whole range of people outside that, families outside that, who just aren't reached.
Yeah. An interesting aspect of your report earlier was the way two of the students referred to, Rebecca Merrigan said her mum was delighted. The young man said his parents were thrilled.
This is the most out, yeah.
Parents are so important in this because fundamentally, I think one of the problems here is a cultural one. It's about the ambition for higher education. It's about an appreciation of the value of higher education. And where that rests or where that is in families, I think there's a very good chance of success.
Would you agree
where it isn't, we need to generate it.
Would you agree with the teachers who will tell you again and again, particularly primary teachers, but not just them, that, I mean, access is fine and encouraging people to come in fifth and sixth year and so on, and giving them guidance and open days and so on. But it all goes back to the child in going into junior infants and what that child knows. Educational disadvantage, you can only, in other words, your authority can only do so much. You can only do so much at the end, at the top of the pyramid, if you're not doing more at the beginning.
This is a whole of education issue, no question at all about that. And it starts in preschool. In fact, it possibly even starts with families. I think there would be value, and I understand the department is considering this, doing a much more comprehensive strategy around equity of access to education. And I think, because I think it does start much earlier on.
Having said that, the fact that there are, and we heard about it in Louise's report, cutbacks in guidance hours in DESH schools, disadvantaged schools, does that concern you?
Well, I think the ESRI report last week, Leaving School in Ireland, indicated that guidance counsellors are an important factor in all this. But look, there's no silver bullet. And, you know, a guidance counsellor, any one guidance counsellor, can only reach so many young people. The case I'm making, I suppose, is that we need to find a much broader, more effective, systemic approach to this, rather than relying on good individuals in particular schools. I think they're enormously valuable and they do wonderful work, but they are not, that alone is not going to achieve the objectives.
Tom Boland of the Higher Education Authority, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's 8.24 and we're going now to hear about a fairly distressing story overnight which has emerged about the dangers of covering the situations in Iraq and Syria particularly are very obvious. The latest figures, I think, about 40 journalists have been killed in Syria alone since the conflict there started. But there's a video which has been circulating online which comes from ISIS extremists in Syria, which shows the murder of one particular by beheading of one American journalist, James Foley, and has threatened another American who is held in that country if the Americans don't end military operations in Iraq. On the line is Rosemary Hollis, Professor of Middle East Policy Studies at the City University in London. And thank you very much for talking to us. The threat is obvious. One man is dead, and circulating online makes the intentions of ISIS even more stark. How effective do you think this is? There evidence for seeing how effective this has been and might be in the future?
You mean as a tactic against the United States? Well, unfortunately, because the person killed was a journalist, the United States has long since let it be known that they're not going to regard journalists in the field at battle sites as a sort of national asset in the same way as, for example, US personnel in Iraqi Kurdistan are regarded as the object for protection in the current US airstrikes on the Islamic State forces. It is, unfortunately, something that we're probably going to see more of, because kidnap and demands in the context of kidnap is one of the methods used by the Islamic State forces. And it's a method used by other militant anti-state forces across the region and has been since the 1980s, if not before.
I suppose the deeper question I was trying to drive out in my clumsy first question to you was the effect of people who are willing to murder people so freely and put it on video and have their followers and other people who have no sense circulate it, the effect and the potency of that threat against the Americans who are obviously who have enormous air power, but in terms of balance of forces, how effective is it and is it likely to be?
Well, they are a very powerful enemy in the sense that they are prepared to fight dirty, as you're implying, and they are on the ground in amongst the civilian population. They have won over members of the civilian population, not universally, but generally, in northern Syria and northern Iraq. And that presents a challenge to the United States, which really cannot be defeated, cannot be rooted out, cannot be ended simply by the use of air power. And therefore, the specter is out there that at some stage, Americans could get drawn in, sucked back into Iraq, sucked into Syria, indeed, on the ground. And at the moment, what the Americans are hoping is that they can persuade and back the Kurds and other Iraqis to do the fighting on the ground rather than having to do it themselves.
Well, thank you for that assessment, Rosemary. And I want to turn now to the original reason we wanted to talk to you, which is what is happening in Gaza. Another ceasefire breaking down and the Israelis bringing their people home from the peace talks in Cairo, where there has been a logjam we've known about. So another ceasefire breaking down, talks breaking down again. How significant?
Well, there are some commonalities in terms of how the Israelis understand the challenge that Hamas represents to them and how the Americans are dealing with the forces of the Islamic State in Iraq, in the sense that what Hamas is doing is hanging out in the Cairo talks for some kind of gain as a result of all the deaths and injuries that they've sustained in this last round of warfare with the Israelis. And they know that at some level, they do have bargaining power at the negotiating table with the Israelis, because ultimately they can tempt the Israelis to go back into Gaza on the ground in an effort to eliminate the Hamas problem, knowing that that would mean heavy casualties for the Israeli soldiers and is therefore something that they don't want to have to do.
Just one something I want to ask you about, which is the role of Egypt in all of this. We know what Hamas is doing. We know what the Israelis are doing. Is the Egyptian government or its rulers under any pressure at all, given that they are party to this conflict and party to sealing off Gaza and preventing people from escaping the attacks which have killed so many?
Well, I think they regard Hamas as their enemy. So they're not exactly even-handed mediators in this situation. And one of the reasons why the conflict is going to rumble on is that at the moment, none of the players involved, apart from Hamas, is prepared to grant Hamas a break. The only game changer that I can think of is if there were international, let's say, spearheaded by the UN, not the US, intervention to say, OK, we're going to require Hamas to look after Gaza in return for the opening up of a port, the possibility of trade with the rest of the world, and they have to vow not to attack Israel for an interim period while we try and restore life and well-being in Gaza, which is a big proposition. But at the moment, that possibility or anything, a game changer like that, is blocked by the fact that both the Egyptians and the Israelis, backed by the Americans, want to deny Hamas a role in the future of Gaza.
Rosemary Hollis, thank you very much.
This woman really doesn't need any introduction, but I'm going to give Evie Nihulavon one anyway, because we're going to be talking about the Science Squad and also Black Yol. Evie!
Hello.
You look gorgeous in your pink.
I'm not at all tired. I look like I'm going to a wedding. But
you look like Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, thanks. It's such a nice thing to say. But the dress is from Arnott's. It's Tara Harmon, and I just love pink as well. So I just thought, might as well take it out for the day.
The cut is stunning. Stunning. And we're going to be talking Science Squad. So look, it's third series.
Yeah, the third series of the Science Squad, which I'm delighted that we're back again. And we kind of have a new look to it this year in that we're making the stories even more human and more realistic, I think, as well. So talking to the scientists, but really showing you where this is going to impact on your own life. So everything from portable x-rays to, you know, new ways of treating newborns to ways of treating water out in the middle of Uganda. And there's just a whole load of stories that I hope will, you know, that everyone will enjoy watching.
I'm really glad you said that. That's the part that I love about the show. And because if you're sitting down yourself, kids, whatever it is, that it's practical.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's got, every show has got, you know, three different stories to it. And you'll come out going, God, I never knew that. But what I really like about it is that we're celebrating research that's happening in Ireland. And really, for such a small country, country, we're on an international scale and stage in terms of science research, and I think we should be celebrating that more. And it's great to see that finally science is now popular and it's part of the geek chic movement. I just think it's a great time to be involved in maths and science and looking at the education of it, and it's where I'm delighted to be. What I loved was when you have a really simple idea that it can transform people's lives. I mean, the SODIS project in Uganda, where you just leave water out in a glass or a plastic bottle for 6 hours and it becomes drinkable. It's such a simple idea. The science of it is so simple and it transforms people's lives. Or else in the Tyndall Institute, where they're trying to make a portable X-ray, this means that you'll be able to bring an X-ray to a crash site. So instead of damaging somebody by moving them, you'll bring the X-ray to them. And that's something, again, that will transform healthcare. So it's really simple ideas where the science doesn't have to necessarily be really technical or complicated, but it's going to make a real difference.
Next step, because you've done some great work. You were working with the DART program. Are we going to get you back on that? Or?
Yeah, we've actually put in an application to increase the DART of physics this year, and hopefully we'll have more university institutions involved in as well. So it could be a Dublin-wide project where we get more people interested in talking about physics.
So in case anybody missed that, just tell us again what that's about.
So with the DART of physics, we ran ads on the DART all about physics, like the moon is escaping the Earth, or the person standing next to you is mostly empty space, or asking questions like, why is the pole that you're holding colder than everything else, even though it's not actually colder, it just feels colder. So things like that that are thought-provoking and that make you go, God, I wonder why that is happening. And then you can go to the website and get the questions answered, or just, you know, say it to your friend. And it's really about bringing physics out of the black and white textbook and into the real world.
It's sad that I get giddy over those things, but Flagyol, what's in store there with John Creedon?
So the Flagyol is down in Sligo for the first year, and from reports so far, it looks to be a hugely exciting programme. It seems that there are going to be more visitors than ever before down there, and we had great fun in Derry last year and in Cavan the year before that, but I think Sligo's going to have another edge to it. So I'll be down with John Creedon, we'll be interviewing musicians, and we'll be interviewing all of our tourists, and we'll be playing a bit of Keol ourselves. So the Flagyol will be out in this autumn series as well.
So naturally, all of that didn't leave you time this year for getaways in between the PhD, was that it?
Unfortunately, no time for getaways this year, so I didn't get any holiday in the sun. I'm really livid about that, and I miss Joe as well to pieces, but I hear Angela's taking care of him, and she'll do a great job when series 3 of Getaways comes out.
Now, where are you with the study? The mammy's coming out in me.
So the thesis is nearly finished. It's a little over 100,000 words, but I think it'll do. So fingers crossed my supervisor gives it the thumbs up and I can, you know, send it on to the next person.
I'm sure it's first class honours as always. Evie, thank you so much for talking to us.
Sorry, thanks a million.
It's the sports at 9:25 with Pádraig Lodge.
Thanks, Christopher. Arsenal drew 0-0 away to Besiktas of Turkey in the first leg of their Champions League playoff. The Gunners had midfielder Aaron Ramsey sent off in a second yellow card with 10 minutes remaining. The second leg will take place at the Emirates Stadium this night week. This evening, Celtic are away to Maribor of Slovenia in the first leg of their Champions League playoff. That game will be shown live on RTE2 television. The Republic of Ireland women's team plays Slovenia in their latest World Cup qualifier tonight. Kick-off at Tallaght Stadium is at 7:30. It's Ireland's last home game in their qualifying campaign, with away games against Slovakia and Germany to come in September. Manager Sue Ronan believes the success of the Irish rugby team at the World Cup is a further sign of the rise of women's sport in Ireland.
The rugby team were fantastic, I have to say. You know, we watched every game, you know, like everybody in the country did, and the heart went out to them when they were beaten in the semi-final. But I think, you know, in days to come, I'm sure they're majorly disappointed still, but in days to come they'll take positives out of losing to the eventual winners. We had a similar situation with our under-19s in the European finals in Norway this summer, when, like that, you know, had taken some big scalps along the way to the semi-finals, and then unfortunately it was like a game too far for them and we lost out to the eventual winners. But women's sport in general in Ireland is on the up. I think, you know, you can see that the resources now in all the various sports are coming to fruition. All the time and effort and money and dedication has been put into all the different sports, now it's bearing fruit. So we're looking forward to seeing more of that on the football side in the coming years.
That's Sue Ronan. Manchester United have reached an agreement to sign Argentina defender Marcos Rojo from Sporting Lisbon. As part of the deal, Nani will return to Lisbon on loan. A new signing, James Rodriguez, scored his first goal for Real Madrid in a 1-1 draw with Atletico Madrid in the Spanish Super Cup. The Galway minor hurling manager Matty Murphy has criticised Galway's participation in the Leinster Senior Championship. Murphy told the Irish Examiner that it had done nothing for hurling in the county, only fattened the coffers of the counties in Leinster. With the lineup for the All-Ireland Hurling Final now complete, the focus is turning to the All-Ireland Football Semi-Finals over the next two Sundays. This Sunday, it's the Connacht champions Mayo against the Munster champions Kerry, and the Kerry manager Eamon Fitzmaurice has been speaking to our Gaelic Games correspondent Brian Carthy about the challenge that Mayo will present.
Well, I think they're ferociously honest. They work very hard for each other, in particular their forwards. They've a good few players in game breakers that can score from anywhere. The likes of Lee Keegan is having a massive season again. Aidan O'Shea, all the lads up front, Killian O'Connor, Alan Dillon, Andy Moore, any of them, Jason Doherty, Kevin McLaughlin is often an underrated player. He's a serious player for them. So they've a lot of very good players all over the field. And I think they're a very united bunch. They seem to be a very honest group. They work very hard for each other. And, they'll be hard nut to crack for us. I don't think there's too many people left over from the 2004-06 games, maybe Andy Moore and Alan Dillon. I don't think there's too many more of them.
But the very fact that they haven't been able to cross the line, do you think is there a concern all the time when they go out to play? Is that in the back of their mind?
I don't think so. I think maybe after games it's a thing that they might think about, but I don't think in the lead into a game or in the lead into big games that they think about that, because players are always going to be optimistic about winning. They plan to win, they train so hard, they're training to win, and if they can get over the line, then they might look back in it and say, that was tough to get over the line, but we got there in the end. So I don't think it's a thing that you dwell on, really. It's a negative and you just move on from it, and it's as simple as that.
Tell me this, how would you evaluate your own team's displays throughout this year's championship?
We've been winning the games. We've mixed the good and the bad. Some games we've, in the Cork game in particular, I suppose we played very well that day. In the other two games, we had patches of good play and patches of poor play. So we probably aren't as consistent as we'd like to be yet. But if we can keep on improving, I'd be happy enough.
Eamon Fitzmaurice. The Judmont International is the feature race at York today. Aidan O'Brien's dual derby winner Australia is the favourite to win the prestigious race, with Michael Stout's Telescope also taking part. Four Irish swimmers will be in action today at the European Swimming Championships in Berlin. Looking ahead is John Kenny.
Having disappointed herself with a 17th place finish yesterday, one place shy of making the semi-final, Sharika McMahon is back in action this morning in the heats of the women's 200 metres individual medley here in Berlin. McMahon, a silver medalist at the Europeans 2 years ago in Hungary, was very emotional after yesterday's swim and was distraught at not making the top 16. The 19-year-old didn't swim well at the recent Commonwealth Games, and it was generally thought that she would perform better here in Berlin. She struggled yesterday. Her finish to the 100 breaststroke was poor, and she'll have to up her game to make it out of the heats of the 200 IM this morning. However, the Texas A&M based swimmer is nothing if not determined, and she'll be hopeful that she can get her championships back on track this morning. It'll be a defining swim for McMahon in terms of what she can expect from the rest of this meet. McMahon is one of four Irish swimmers in action this morning. Dan Sweeney, Nicholas Quinn and Brendan Hyland are all in action in their main events. Hyland has been in action in two races so far in order to get ready for his big discipline, the 200 butterfly, but the talent swimmer may have to get close to his own Irish record to progress. Quinn and Sweeney both produced personal bests in the men's 100 breaststroke on Monday. They will hope to do likewise in the 200 this morning.
At the IPC European Athletics Championships in Swansea, Derry sprinter Jason Smith was an emphatic winner of his category of the 100 metres, clocking 10.78 seconds. And Leicester have signed New Zealand World Cup winner Brad Thorne. The 39-year-old lock will arrive at Welford Road within the next month.
Welcome back and listen to Morning Ireland at coming up to 17 minutes to 9, and we're joined by our agricultural correspondent George Lee. Welcome, George. You were listening to some very angry people last night in Navan. Tell us about it.
In Navan, indeed. The IFA organised a meeting. It's their first of four regional meetings over the beef crisis, which is deteriorating significantly. A huge amount of anger and frustration expressed by farmers. The IFA leadership are also under significant pressure from a particular organisation who are calling themselves Grassroots IFA, who are very unhappy with the rate of progress and the way in which the beef crisis is being tackled, particularly angry about what they feel is a stranglehold that factories have over the whole industry and the prices and the crisis which is there. So there was tension in the air anyway.
So the first of four meetings, who was at it? How many were at it, first
about,
of all?
About 250 farmers, if I were to estimate, because I think there was about 100 seats on each side and there was an overflow down at the back. But the heat and the temperament in the room gloom left nothing to the imagination. These farmers are pulling their hair out over what exactly is going on in relation to the beef industry, and it's in the crisis is getting deeper and deeper. They've suffered very significant losses. They're down about 200 euro per animal that they're producing since last year, and none of them are making money at all, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel. It's gone on since last October, and they're at the wit's end at this stage, and they're very, very annoyed with the rate of progress. Some of them are blaming the minister, some of them are blaming the IFA, some of them are blaming the meat factories, but they are absolutely desperate at this stage.
The problem is the spec has changed.
There are many problems, but the crisis started because what the factories were buying in response to their markets in the UK, the specification was changed about last October. It started with bull beef. Now, typically a bull calf would be about 2 years by the time a farmer would have it ready. It would take that period of time, and there's obviously a lag. You can't change the production of them. You can't suddenly have them ready. But out of nowhere, the specifications were changed by the British factories, and they wanted bull beef at about 16 months old. It left an awful lot of Irish farmers with beef they couldn't actually get killed, or they couldn't get slaughtered and so on, and it left them with significant losses. It was a major, major crisis. Other problems were there in relation to the factories, the stranglehold which they have, which is the way farmers look upon it, and the fact that export markets were restricted, and problems with labelling and trying to get markets in Northern Ireland opened up, and in the UK opened up for exports as well. So there are significant problems. The issue last night, which kind of was raised by a beef industry representative from Dunbia, was that it looks as if the specifications are going to be tightened even further. That the 16-month age limit for bull beef is going to be reduced by some of the main retailers already to 14 months and possibly to 12 months. And that was just greeted with the most aghast response from farmers. They just feel that they couldn't possibly produce beef like that. And basically, it's their most important market.
Now, a layperson listening to you is going to say the obvious thing, that if the buyer doesn't want to buy what you're selling, then you've got the problem.
Well, the problem with it is that the buyer has changed the specification as a result, according to the meat factory man, of the fallout from the horse meat scandal. And the horse meat scandal, it wasn't farmers who put the horse meat into the burgers, but it is the farmers who are paying the price completely.
How does this connect?
It connects because there were two issues, I think, is the way he explained it. Obviously, as a result of the horse meat crisis at the time, prices for quality beef went up, so there were good prices. A lot of extra production was done, and so farmers got tied into the factories had extra stuff on hand. Since then, the British buyers have decided they have a bigger preference for British beef and also stricter requirements in terms of age. And so they have tightened their standards, and it's all been imposed very quickly and very suddenly, and Irish beef producers have been caught out by that trap as such. And so that in essence, there was an overhang of beef in the factories, which resulted in them killing less, all at the same time that the specifications were changed, and the whole thing has got from bad to worse.
Now, the angry people you are listening to, the farmers, what do they want done? Or do they know what the answer is?
Oh, they need some relief. There are none of them making any money. And the rates of return and the rates of income in beef production, when you look at the Chagas reports, it's very, very low. The farm family incomes for beef are averaging, for certain finishers, about 9,500 euro per year, and 15,000 to 16,000 euro for others. And that's an average, and that's done on a very considerable look by Chagas in relation to the accounts and how these farms are run. So that is serious. They're low income farmers, and they're not making any money. What they want done is they want many things done. They want the factories to basically change the specifications, and they're very irate about the fact that it's British retailers and a handful of them who are dictating these standards. They've already invested huge amounts of money in quality assurance processes, because they're fitting in with a quality assurance scheme by Bord Bia, which is aimed at marketing a very good image for Irish beef. And so they had invested a lot and gone along with that, but it seems that isn't enough, because the factories, by virtue of what their buyers in the UK are looking for, have imposed other standards. The prices that they're getting, the agreement prices in terms of the quality assurance prices, have also been ripped up, those kind of agreements, and they're getting less and less for that. They want problems in relation to accessing and selling into the Northern Ireland market in particular, in relation to labelling what is Irish beef, and what will they take for British retailers. They want them addressed. For instance, the British retailers will take beef, which says it was produced in the UK. They'll say it was or Northern Ireland. They will accept beef produced in Ireland in the Republic as well, but they will not accept something which is more or less raised in one jurisdiction but finished in another. So they'll take one pure, either Ireland or the UK, but not mixed, and that is a huge problem for the sale of the beef. There are very, very many but the issues which they have, but they are getting particularly irate in relation to the response from the Minister for Agriculture, and that became clear last night.
And that's been fairly clear, and his response is basically talk to the producers, to talk to the meat plants.
Actually, what he is saying is that he's not responsible for price. What they're saying back is, but you are responsible for competition. And he does accept that. And they're saying there is not enough competition among the factories. There are three main factories who have the lion's share, and they're calling the shots. But really, ultimately, it's not just factories, it's retailers in the UK.
Well, it sounds like it's a situation that is getting worse and looks like it will go on getting worse. They're to have further meetings. But just one thing, journalists were asked to leave, including yourself.
It was extremely... Well, the meeting was very, very, very heated. Now, at one stage, it looked as if they weren't even going to let the representative from the beef industry speak at all. I saw him packing his bags. It looked to me as if he was going to go. It went on. It is an insult to have to listen to the factories, is what some of them were saying. That he's sitting there going to tell us whatever he's going to tell while his bosses at home are planning to cut the prices. There have been cuts in prices already in the last 2 weeks for beef. They're down about 15 cents per kilo. So farmers are really, really getting desperate. In the end, the IFA is under enormous pressure from that group, as you were calling themselves, Grassroots IFA. And I believe that there's an extent to which, with media there, that it was getting more and more irate because it raises the temperature on them. For whatever reason, by 11 o'clock, after the meeting started at 8:30, they asked the media to leave because they wanted to have a private or an in-house farmers' meeting. But I can tell you there's skin and hair flying, and the IFA is under enormous pressure from sections of their members, and they're going to put enormous pressure on the minister in response. This is not getting any way better anytime soon.
George Lee, thank you very much. 10 to 9.
Well, it's been going for 73 years. Virginia Agricultural Show takes place again in Cavan today. It's a combination of serious business of the sort George Lee has been talking about just there, and hopefully an enjoyable family day out. Among the visual highlights, the major one is judging in the competition for the best Irish dairy cow. All of the entries are Holstein Friesians. Brendan Smith is the competition director for what's being branded as the Diageo Bailey's Irish Champion Cow Competition. He's on the line. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Diageo, of course, makes a famous black and white drink. What's their interest in a competition to judge black and white cows?
Well, their interest is that in the black and white drink is the cream for Bailey's is produced in Virginia, in Glanbia Ingredients factory in Virginia, and they were asked to sponsor this competition.
So they've big links. Now,
yes.
The competition itself, it's a modest enough prize, I think 2,500, but it's very significant in terms of enhancing the winning cow's value.
Yeah, well, the prize itself is a high prize in competitions like this in Ireland. In fact, it is the highest prize for any competition of its type in Ireland. Yes, it does enhance the value of the owner of the cow, but generally those cows do not come on the market. They're usually retained in the herd
for breeding.
To continue on the breeding progeny.
Okay, so the straws of those cows then are the embryos. What sort of value would attach to those?
Well, the breeding process would be yes. So sometimes they're done with embryos and that they would have a very significant value, perhaps something in the region of €100.
Right. Okay. Well, now Virginia Show, it happens today. It's been going a long time. It's a deal smaller, is it not, than the Tullamore Show and obviously the annual big extravaganza in Laois. But it's still very important.
It is. It's a very popular regional show, but it has an all-Ireland reach with a competition like the Dairy Cow competition. It attracts a good crowd of perhaps 15 to 20,000 people.
Now, if I'm at the tail end of the summer holidays with children, how would I convince them to attend? Obviously, I don't want them exposed to too much alcohol marketing in the competition end of it, but what's there for young people to see?
There's a whole range of competitions right across the board. There's photography, painting. There's there's children's classes there, And you know, it's a very broadly based. Actually, there are 16 different sections in the show in total. The main ones being, I suppose, the livestock and that end of it, and fruit and flowers and home industries. It's a very, very broadly based show.
And the entire gamut of cattle breeds is there. You've got Charolais, Simmentals, Frisians, Herefords, Belgian Blues, Blonde Aquitains and Limousins. Like, there's everything to see there in terms of the national herd in this country.
There is indeed. Actually, there are over 100 cattle classes, and that covers the entire breeds, as you mentioned there, right across the board.
Agricultural shows, a sense perhaps in recent years that they've struggled to attract the numbers, struggled to attract the support. Is that something you found in Virginia, and how has it been addressed?
Well, Virginia has always done well. They have new competitions on there. For instance, now today, apart from all the cattle tests and that, there's a cookery demonstration with Devin Maguire. And one of the highlights of the show today is the opening of the new event centre, which the Show Society have just completed this year at a cost of €1 million. So it's a big day for the new centre.
Okay, Brendan Smith, we leave it there. That's Brendan Smith of Virginia Show. Thank you very much for joining us. The 55th Rose of Tralee was crowned last night. Haley O'Sullivan, the 2013 Rose, she was from Washington, passed the crown to the Philadelphia Rose, Maria Walsh, at the Dome in Tralee. Maria Walsh, we can speak to her on the line from Tralee. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Not too bad at all, and well done. Congratulations. Have you had much sleep?
I've had a few hours.
What's a few hours now?
Yes.
Partying, partying, or just a very late night with all the protocols attached to your new role?
There's a few protocols, but I was quite sensible.
Good. Now, because you are a pioneer, I mean, we've just been talking about the Virginia Agricultural Show, where one of the big competitions is sponsored by a drinks company. But you are a pioneer.
I am. I made my pledge when I was 12.
And how have you found growing up in, you know, maintaining that discipline? Because we hear so much about binge drinking now amongst young people.
Mm-hmm. I was always fine with it. There was obviously peer pressures along the line, particularly when I was a teenager. But for me, I never needed it to benefit anything. So I never felt that. Obviously, I knew they were there, and I was very much aware of them. But no, I'm usually the first on the dance floor and last to leave, so alcohol is never needed.
Okay, well, listen, the year ahead, what do you plan to do?
Once I get my feet on the ground and come off Cloud Nine, I'll start planning. This is all very surreal for me, so I haven't put any pen to paper quite yet, but hopefully I will be able to provide Kerry and the festival just as much as I can.
Well, let's have a tribute from your own father, Vincent, who says he's very confident you're going to do a great job.
She's a brilliant girl, an absolutely brilliant girl, solid, true, worthy of her job. She will do a brilliant job to represent Philadelphia in the Rose of Tralee. She'll be a great ambassador for both Ireland and the Rose of Tralee. She most definitely will be.
There you go. You have a father who obviously thinks extraordinarily highly of you. But your family, there are very limited Philadelphia connections. You yourself have just lived there for 4 years. The rest of the family, no tentacles in that part of the world.
No, I mean, I was born in Boston, and that's where a majority of my family are, like aunts and uncles, cousins. I was in New York for 2 years, and Philadelphia, a job opportunity came up in Philly, and I said, sure, why not? I've never been. Nobody has ever been from my family, so we'll try and see what this great city is about. And I did, and I fell in love with it. So I've been there nearly 3 years and loving every day of it.
Well, we're going to hear a clip from the Philadelphia Irish Centre representative, Elizabeth Spellman. She said your win's going to have a very positive effect on the Irish community back home in Philadelphia.
For our centre, this is great. It's the first time Philadelphia proper has won. Pennsylvania won in 78, and that centre doesn't exist anymore. So now Philly proper to bring the crown home is so wonderful, and it'll be great for the Rose of Tralee and our Irish community in Philly.
Now, Maria, what's the rest of the day got in store for you?
I believe our communications manager, John Jeremy, has a few interviews lined up for a while, and then I believe I'm heading off to Killarney Races with the fellow Roses. Currently I'm sitting on a big Ferris wheel looking out over the beautiful lands of Kerry. So far, even in the hours this morning, I'm doing pretty well.
Now, your mother is, she was born in Boston, a bit like yourself, as you say, but she moved to Littermore in Connemara. They will want to see you, I'm sure, there. Have you any plans to visit?
Yes, I'm planning on heading home to Shrule first and then on to Derrynbogue, Littermore in the next day or two. My mother puts food on the table in front of me, so it's very important that I represent her area.
Yes, well, there is a certain ownership of you, I'm sure, up there, yes. And indeed in Boston, and indeed in Philadelphia. Well, Maria Walsh, thank you very much for joining us from your victory last night in Tralee. Well done to everyone who participated.